Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This is a special bonus episode that is an update episode, but it's also special for another reason. But I'm going to start off by introducing myself as always. I'm Rabia Chaudhry, attorney and author of A Non-Story, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Hey, Susan. Hey, Colin.
Hey, Rabia.
Hey.
So, two reasons we're doing this episode. Number one, it's been a long time, I think, since we've done kind of an update on, I don't know if we've ever done an episode with an update on every single case. This might be the first time we're doing that. But the reason we're going to do that is because this is not just a season finale episode. This is actually a series finale episode. After 7 years, Undisclosed is closing the curtains. This will be our final episode of our show. Now, we might be coming back once in a while, maybe in our feed, to drop some, like, if something big happens in one of these cases, because certainly I don't think any of us are just, like, walking away from the cases that we've been working on, right, guys?
Not at all.
No,
not at all. So, you know, if something big happens, we might pop in just to do something kind of informal, but you're not going to be getting any more Undisclosed seasons. So I will say, though, please stay subscribed, because what we do want to be doing is, and we'll talk about this at the end, but we might be plugging like new projects and stuff we're doing. And like I said, coming back to tell you about any major developments in our case. So we're going to start by asking Colin to give us kind of like this grand 30,000 foot overview of like all we've done in 7 years. And we've done a lot.
It's been a crazy ride.
Yeah, quite a lot. So whether through longer series, mini series, or special episodes, we've covered a total of 27 cases over the last years of Undisclosed. 15 of the people whose cases we've covered have gotten some type of relief. 11 of those were defendants who were exonerated. So I'll go through that list. We have Sean Thomas, who was exonerated in Philadelphia, has since gotten a civil settlement of $4.15 million. Second, Terrence Lewis, also in Philadelphia, exonerated of a homicide, had a civil settlement of $6.25 million, and has since started the Terrence Lewis Liberation Fund, which is working to fight wrongful convictions. It's working out of the University of Pennsylvania. Third, we have Willie Vesey, another one of our Philadelphia defendants. He was exonerated of a murder and has reached a civil settlement of $5 million with the city of Philadelphia. Also in Philadelphia, we have Chester Holman III, who was exonerated of a murder and got a civil settlement of $9.8 million.
Philly is really paying up.
Yes, Philadelphia has had to pad of its coffers based on some undisclosed cases. Moving down to North Carolina, we had a special episode on Charles Ray Finch, who was wrongfully convicted for about four decades. He got a civil settlement of $2 million, but unfortunately, soon after being released from prison, he passed away. Yet another Philadelphia case, Theophilus Wilson, was a special episode. He was exonerated of a double homicide. He has a pending civil action, is seeking damages from the city of Philadelphia. Jonathan Irons, he was exonerated of a home break-in and shooting in Missouri and has a pending civil action against various defendants in Missouri. Dennis Perry, out of Georgia, of course, was exonerated based on a double homicide after mitochondrial DNA testing. Georgia does not have a wrongful conviction compensation law, but representatives can pass legislation in specific cases, and there's a bipartisan resolution for $1.4 million for Dennis Perry in the works. Ronnie Long, who was wrongfully convicted for about 43, 44 years in North Carolina, he got the maximum compensation after exoneration in North Carolina of $750,000. He has a pending civil action seeking more in damages from the state of North Carolina. Joseph Webster was exonerated of a murder in the Nashville area. He has a pending civil action against Nashville for damages. Darrell Ewing was exonerated of a murder in the Detroit area. Despite a full confession by an alternate suspect, he has a pending retrial where the prosecution is trying to bring him back on charges of homicide. We also had two defendants released without exoneration, special episodes on Centoya Brown and Cyrus Wilson. Both of those received parole. We had two special episodes, if you recall, where we asked you to contact officials where we had pending executions, And in those two special episodes, Marcellus Williams out of Missouri and William Montgomery out of Ohio, we had stays of execution, and both of those are currently still stayed. That leaves us then with a total of 12 cases that are currently unresolved, and we'll focus on those 12 cases throughout the rest of this episode.
And I think a common theme is going to be that for a lot of them, the pandemic has essentially ground many court functions to a halt, and progress that would have happened has been stalled out since March of 2020.
Yeah, 2 years. We've lost 2 years in a lot, you know, in a lot of these cases. Those things have shut down. But you guys, I was wondering, do you guys know how many episodes we've done total?
No. Do you?
I do. Do you know, Colin?
My guess would be around 420, but that's just a guess.
That's a very close. When this episode drops, it will be our 439th episode.
Damn.
That's a lot of episodes, folks. And I was just thinking the other day back to, and you know, it's been a blur, but wasn't there a time when we were going year round, two episodes a week?
There was. There was.
Why? Were we insane? That must have been before, God, I can't imagine I would have done that, like after I had Yasin, which he's my son who's turning actually 5 today. Which brings me to actually some news that I want to talk about. Susan Simpson has become a mama.
I have.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thanks.
Tell us all about Serafina.
She does not like it when I sleep or eat.
Who named her? Who named her? I gotta ask about the name, by the way. So unusual, beautiful name.
It was mostly because between my husband and I, we ruled out every single other name in the history of the universe, and we both like that one. So we're like, well, that guess that's it.
What does it mean? What does Seraphine mean?
So technically, it was a type of angel from the Old Testament, but later, after we named her, I learned that it means fiery flying serpent. So I'm now going with it means dragon, and she's officially named after a dragon. But that was after the fact that we learned that.
I love it. Well, you know, some people would make the argument that an Old Testament angel is kind of like a fiery flying object. That's great. So again, okay, sorry. How old is she now?
She is 5 weeks.
Wow. How are you doing?
I'm surviving. Mm-hmm. I was doing pretty good, I think, until I caught some kind of a plague, as you may tell from my voice. Hopefully recovering now, but we're still hanging in there.
Well, look, she's absolutely beautiful. If you guys want to check out pictures of Serafina, you can go to Susan Simpson. I've seen her on Instagram and I've seen her on Twitter, right? Really, really cute. She's adorable. She looks like you to me, but you know, it's a little early.
See, I look at her and I'm like, I don't see either me or my husband in her. I'm like,
Yeah. But you know, this is that stage where they're just kind of like a pale little mush. It's a little hard to tell.
Cute little potatoes.
Little potato. Yeah, by 6 months, you're going to be like, wait a minute, that's his nose. All right, Susan. So again, congratulations. But now let's get into the case that I think you get asked the most about in all these years, and that's Joey Watkins.
Well, after 2 years of being stalled out from COVID, Joey Watkins had a hearing on Monday, finally. Now, to give a quick recap on how we got here, Joey's was the second season we did of Undisclosed from Floyd County, Georgia. He was convicted in 2001 of a murder of a man named Isaac Dawkins, who was driving along a highway and was shot in the head by another car and was killed. Joey was represented by the Georgia Innocence Project, who reached out to us in 2015, I think, and asked if we'd look at his case for a new season of Undisclosed, and we took it on. And after our season ended in January 2017, his attorneys filed for a habeas petition on his behalf based on what we'd found for the podcast. Now, that habeas was based on predominantly two issues. First was the juror misconduct issue. When I spoke to a juror in the case, I learned that she had done a drive test during deliberations. She had gone out and driven the route that she thought the prosecutor said Joey would have had to drive that night, which the defense argued would have proved it was impossible for Joey to commit the crime based on cell evidence and distances involved. She did a drive and after doing that, changed her vote from not guilty to guilty, thinking that maybe it was possible he could have done it, which is not permitted. Under the Constitution, jurors are not allowed to do their own independent fact-finding, and they're definitely not allowed to come back and bring it to other jurors as this one did. The other issue was Grave Dog. Now, one of the allegations in the Watkins case was that after killing Isaac Dawkins, he had then killed a dog and put it on the victim's grave. What we discovered in our investigation was that, in fact, there was evidence, ballistics evidence, that showed that the killing of the grave dog was not connected in any way to Joey Watkins. But that evidence had been hidden under a new secret case number by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation and would never have been discoverable if it hadn't for the fact that Claire Gilbert, the head of GIP, managed to track down a medical examiner who apparently was a data hoarder and kept a list of his a case log, essentially, going back to 2001 in a closet. He pulled that out for her, looked down it, saw a record of an autopsy of a dead dog. And with that case number, we were able to obtain records showing that, in fact, they had known that the GBI, that the investigators from Floyd County had known that Grave Dog was not connected ballistically in any way to the Joey Watkins case. So back in 2017, the state opposed that habeas petition on the grounds that Joey had waived any right to challenge his conviction due to delays and due to the fact he'd previously had another habeas petition based on cell evidence. And under Georgia law, there's a procedural bar that says you can't bring a case, bring a habeas petition after 4 years or after you've already done a previous one. However, there's an exception for that in cases where it was not the new evidence that the new petition is based on was not reasonably available or not really readily discoverable, which in this case, I think, is clearly applies. For one, the secret case number was not obtainable by any reasonable method, and the juror had never spoken to him before, so that information had not been available to Joey. In 2018, there was a hearing held only on the procedural bar. So basically, it was a hearing to determine if Joey had a right to a hearing. And the trial court ruled against Joey. Joey appealed that to the Georgia Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court declined to hear it. It's a discretionary appeal. They didn't rule on it at the time. They just said, no, we're not going to hear this. We're not going to rule one way or another. Bye. Joey filed a motion for reconsideration, which is never granted. Those never get granted ever. Only this time it did. The court agreed to hear it. That happened in 2019. And then in March of 2020, the Supreme Court finally ruled on it and overturned the trial court's decision and said that, yes, Joey was entitled to bring his claims before the court. There should be a hearing on the merits to determine whether or not he's entitled to a new trial. Of course, March 2020 was not a great time to get a new opening in your case because things stopped moving. Now, on February 28th, 2022, Joey finally got his day in court. The hearing lasted 2 days. It's not concluded yet, but so far it has gone fantastically, I believe, from what I've heard.
Are you able to listen to it in real time? Or
no, I'm a witness, so I could not actually listen to the or follow along the first day and a bit of testimony because of sequestration. So what I do know is that the witnesses that the Joey's attorneys put on, everything went to plan, basically. The juror that did the drive test testified about what she'd done. She said that, yes, on the weekend where they broke for deliberations, she was in the area where Joey supposedly had done this drive to do the murder. And she thought, you know what, I'm going to test this out and see if I think it's possible. The issue, of course, is that what she did is not the right route. She drove it backwards and did not go to the right starting and ending points because those points were never explained to her in the trial, which means, one, her results weren't relevant to the case, and two, that aside, jurors are not allowed to do that. Jurors are not allowed to bring in outside information. And what's critical in this case is that the juror who did the drive test had been a holdout. She had been one of about three jurors who did not want to convict initially. They were not convinced by the evidence. They had problems with it.
But Susan, can I ask you a question? And maybe this was answered years ago when you covered this case. Does that even matter? Or is it just enough to get them a new trial that the juror broke, like, the rule, basically, violated the jury's instruction?
It has to be material. It has to be something that would have an effect. Now, the catch to that, though, is that the federal rule 606 is adopted in Georgia as well. And you're not allowed to ask jurors about what happened during deliberations or why they made certain decisions, which is unfortunate because on the one hand, like, what matters is it would be really important evidence for the trial court to hear this juror say, I was going to quit and then I did my outside drive test and changed my vote. That testimony is not allowed. But I do think in this case, the record's going to show just how material that information was. And plus, there's the fact that they were going to vote to acquit and change their vote. So there's an implication there. That's why it happened. Even if she couldn't say in the stand, that is why. The state's case I could watch now after I testified. I was there to testify to dates. One of the issues is how long after finding new information you file a habeas petition. So I was there to talk about when I learned this information and give it to GIP. And the state's, the AG who was representing the state in this case, called a witness, another juror, who he apparently believed was going to testify that she never, that no one had ever done a drive test, that she, that that had not happened. He was trying to rebut the testimony from.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he calls her to the stand remotely. She gets her audio working. And she says, I can't remember if it was a man or a woman, but I recall someone doing a drive test and telling us about it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, that is like a trial attorney's nightmare right there. I have never, I mean, the way the prosecutor said no further questions and like slunk away, I mean, I kind of fell for him, but not really.
I mean, was there any cross for that witness or that was it?
Was there was a, I believe there was a cross plan, but Joy's attorneys apparently decided after that that there was no need.
We're good.
Yeah. So, but everything seems to have gone exactly as you'd hope. The witnesses said what they, we knew they, their past statements had been, for Joey anyway, not so much for the state. And there were two witnesses who were not available now, one of them being Prosecutor Tammy Colston. So the hearing will continue on March 25th. But after that, we're hoping that there'll be a relatively quick ruling from the trial court. Now, whatever happens, whatever the trial court decides, there'll be an appeal. If the trial court rules in favor of Joey and the state, they will appeal and they get an appeal by right. The Supreme Court has to hear it. If the trial court rules for the state, Joey will appeal, but the Supreme Court does not have to hear it. So they have to choose whether or not they want to spend time on their docket on this, which if that happens, hopefully they will. But now that things are moving again, realistically, within a year or so, we could have a final answer on his habeas petition.
So can, first of all, can our listeners watch this when the hearing continues on the 25th or no?
I don't believe they can, but I will check into that and put out an update.
Okay, so the possible outcome of this, like let's say at the end of whatever appellate road this goes down, that it ends up in Joey's favor. That means what then for Joey? It means a new trial for Joey?
It means his conviction's overturned and theoretically a new trial. Now, I just remain skeptical that they would do that, but it's possible. In which case, maybe 2023, they're picking a jury to hear his case again.
Well, it is good news that the hearing finally took place and it went so great. And gosh, I think everybody can thank Susan Simpson for this. for this. Amazing work, Susan. Amazing work. All right. So what about Dennis?
Dennis Perry, he was freed in 2020. We had an update episode on his hearing. There, one point worth noting is that the man whose mitochondrial DNA matched the mitochondrial DNA found at the crime scene, Eric Spahr, has still not been arrested. I know there was a GBI investigation being planned, but it is not clear whether they're actually planning to pursue it. So that there could be no updates there. That could be an unsatisfying conclusion to finding out what really happened in this case. But Dennis is home. He's with his wife. He's finally living his life again.
Are you saying that nobody knows where Eric is or just that?
I'm pretty sure they found him. I've heard like secondhand that GBI was able to like get in touch with him. I don't know if he's still in semi-hiding. I've heard that he was at some point contacted and talked to. As far as I know, they have not done anything further on the case of his mother, who mysteriously died right after it was revealed in court that she'd given her hair sample, which is what tied Eric Spahr's mitochondrial DNA to the crime scene.
Died or was killed?
Well, that inconclusive.
Oh.
Yeah, there was never a cause of death determined that I'm aware of.
I do remember when you first told us that she had given a hair sample that at that time you expressed, at least to Colin and I, that you were really worried about her and her safety.
I was. And then nothing happened to her. And I, you know, I thought it was a far-fetched, you know, unnecessary concern. And then the hearing happened. And next thing we know is that her body was found and she was last seen alive about the time of the hearing. But the other update I wanted to mention is that the prosecutor in the case, not the original prosecutor, but the one who represented the state for Dennis's motion for a new trial based on DNA, her office argued that even though this DNA evidence is strongly exculpatory, because Dennis Perry had allegedly waived his right to ever challenge his conviction in order to avoid being executed, that it didn't matter, and that he was not allowed to ever go before a court and point out the fact that the DNA shows he's innocent. That argument lost, thankfully, but she was then voted out of office, and then she was charged and arrested for violating her oath of office and obstructing arrest in the Ahmaud Arbery case. So her trial is currently pending, last I heard.
She was that delightful woman.
Yep, she's that one.
All right.
And then there's Terrence Lewis. He was freed in 2019, as Colin mentioned. But in 2021, there was another update in the case. Now, Terrence Lewis was convicted of a murder in a house in Philadelphia. There were three men came in, two residents, got into an altercation, and shot and killed a man inside the house. Now, three people were convicted: Terrence Lewis, Jamar Gladden, a third man. The third man does not dispute his guilt. He was definitely there. Terrence Lewis has always maintained he was never there in the first place. But the co-defendant, Jamar Gladden, has always said that he too was wrongfully convicted, that he was at the house that night, but he was not part of the murder. And there was quite a good deal of evidence that kind of supported that conclusion from when we were looking into it. The evidence was not as strong of his innocence as it was for Terrence Lewis. Jamar Gladden was there. It's harder to make a decisive determination one way or another. But in 2021, he was freed from prison too. He was given an offer of time served, essentially, and released immediately. He could not be exonerated because, as the CIU found, it just wasn't strong enough evidence of that. But there were serious questions raised. And this, to me, seems very much the right result. So both Jamar Gladden and Terrence Lewis are now home.
Mm. That's great news.
And then there's the case of Jeff Titus. His case is still pending. There's not much to talk about there yet. I will say I'm optimistic about the future.
When you say pending, can you explain us where?
There have been no current developments, primarily because of COVID. Stuff that was in progress stalled out once the mid-2021, when the new wave happened, and hopefully will pick up again. But there's still work behind the scenes going on there, and I'm hopeful that he too will have a chance to have the evidence in his case heard by court and one day clear his name.
Okay, so he's got a legal team working on it, but right now he's not in court right now.
Yeah, nothing right now, but work in progress.
All right, so we're going to move on to Colin's cases.
Yeah, so I'll start with the case of Jamar Huggins. This is a case out of Conway, South Carolina, where a woman was robbed at gunpoint by two masked men and one woman. The woman was D'Angela Montgomery. In her police interview, she named Jamar Huggins as one of the masked men. In her police interview, she said that at trial she recanted, but despite that, Jamar Huggins was convicted. Now, D'Angela Montgomery has not only recanted, she has given us the name of the actual masked man who committed this home invasion with her. And there's other significant evidence that connects this man to the crime. And so I am working with Jamar's attorney on his current appeal in that case. It's been delayed by COVID, but we're hoping it's going to proceed soon. I'm also working with the attorney on a new South Carolina case where we think there's another wrongful conviction unrelated to Jamar Huggins. And so I'll provide you updates on both of those cases as they come down the pipes. Second, another case delayed by COVID is the case of Pamela Neer. Pam's husband, Doran, died from arsenic poisoning on their turkey farm in North Carolina. It turns out, as we laid out in the podcast, that they were using a turkey medication called 3-nitro, and that medication was recalled based upon its arsenic content and the dangers it posed. And it turned out that Doran was using that 3-nitro as a hangover medication. And I spoke to numerous experts, and their conclusion is that his arsenic level is fully explained by his ingestion of the 3-nitro. And so the Wake Forest Innocence Clinic is working on her appeal, and we hope to have some news on that soon.
Her case is one of the ones that has stuck with me, I think, the strongest over the years. And I swear to God, every time I'm flipping through the TV, that stupid Snapped episode, whatever it is, and her case is on, and I get so angry every time.
Yeah, and another aspect of that, too, is she had two husbands who died. Her first husband died when he fell into the intercoastal waterway while checking crab pots, and they botched the excavation and autopsy on him. So after Doran died, they excavated his body, did testing, and found Although he didn't die from arsenic poisoning, he had elevated levels of arsenic. It turns out they transposed the number from Doran's autopsy to Johnny's autopsy, and so that was another mistake at trial. And
we're certainly
hopeful when this appeal is eventually heard that it's a slam dunk in terms of her conviction being tossed.
So she's just waiting for a hearing? Is that what's happening right now?
She's correct. Everything is just backlogged there in North Carolina, and so they're working on it, and you know, hopefully this year she'll finally get that's her bike for him.
How old is Pam now?
She's, I think, in her 60s at this point. I'm not sure, but yeah, actual age, yeah.
I thought she was a lot older, so that's always a concern, too. And then COVID has run rampant through the prisons, so all of these delays have such an impact on people, people don't realize.
Yeah, and a number of our quote-unquote clients from Undisclosed have had COVID and have struggled through it, and it remains a significant danger. So that's definitely a concern for many of our inmates who are elderly and suffer from various physical ailments. A case that we knew when we took it was not going to be too promising from a legal perspective is the case of Rocky Myers. He was convicted of murdering his neighbor, Ludie Mae Tucker, after a physical struggle in her house. The issue is he has severe eczema, and despite that, there was no physical evidence tying him to the crime scene, and experts have said it's exceedingly unlikely, verging on impossible, that he would have committed this murder with his eczema and not left behind, you know, skin, hair, etc. We noted in the series, though, that he, even more so than Dennis Perry, was out of appeal, so he cannot appeal his conviction, but his is one of a number of cases remaining in this country of judicial override, which Alabama used to have. The jury, because many jurors thought he was not guilty, they compromised. They found him guilty, but voted 9-3 in favor of a life sentence as opposed to a death sentence. And so in the event his number is called and his execution is scheduled, he can appeal claiming that this judicial override was unconstitutional, and I'll certainly be working with his team in the event that that arises.
Let me just understand this correctly. The jury voted in favor of a life sentence, but the judge overruled that and instituted a death sentence. Is that what happened?
Correct. There used to be a few states, namely Delaware, Alabama, and Florida, that said even if the jury votes for a life sentence, the judge can override that and impose a death sentence. As you can imagine, this had racial implications. As you can imagine, there are certain judges, including the judges in Rocky Myers' case, who always overturned a life sentence in favor of a death sentence and never vice versa. And so, yeah, that's no state now allows this. And yet, you know, Rocky Myers is still on death row based upon this judicial override.
So if he were scheduled for execution, he could appeal which part of this? He could just file any kind of an appeal to address any issues in the case, or it would just be on the sentencing issue?
Yeah, just the sentencing issue. Now, he can seek a pardon with the governor, Kay Ivey, in Alabama. He can try to get a pardon. But yeah, just in terms of legal appeals in court, he can just appeal the death sentence at this point.
Even if brand new evidence emerges.
Right. There's not currently a mechanism for him to, you know, and it's similar. You know, he's a case, Rocky Myers, where he had a borderline IQ and there were questions about his competence. And this is similar in Tennessee with what happened with Purvis Payne recently, is that there's not a mechanism to get that heard in court in Alabama. Tennessee currently has legislation. Alabama does not. And so that's another possibility. If Alabama passes retroactive legislation, he could have his day in court. But currently he has no avenues to appeal.
It's awful. Okay.
We noted before some of the Philadelphia cases we covered that had exonerations. One that is not is a special episode we did on Pedro Reynoso, which I regard as kind of crazy because I think his might be the strongest case of innocence we've covered, although the next one we'll cover in a second is also up there. Pedro Reynoso was convicted of a double homicide of Charles Rivera and Carlos Torres in Philadelphia in 1991. There was, however, significant evidence not presented at trial that shows he was in the Dominican Republic at the time of this murder, as well as evidence that an alternate suspect committed the murder. His case is currently being reviewed by the Philadelphia Conviction Integrity Unit. I hope eventually that, as with our other cases, they have an exoneration here, but his case is still currently pending. And he has health issues. He's certainly a person who's impacted by COVID.
And I want to note that the Philadelphia CIU, they came into existence, a few years ago, maybe 2019? They already existed, but under the...
They existed. Yeah.
Well, they had a CIU. It didn't.
Yeah, in name only.
Yes, exactly. But they've now become a real CIU, and watching what they've been doing, I've been really impressed with their program. And I think that it's a model that other CIUs around the country should look to emulate.
Yeah, we could thank Larry Krasner for that.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. And another great CIU is in Michigan. It's in Wayne County, and they've also started recently a statewide one, and that's what's going on in the Temujin Kensu case, which he was previously known as Fred Freeman. This is almost on par with the Pedro Reynoso case in that he was convicted of the murder of Scott Macklem. That was in Port Huron, Michigan. He was seen in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan at a karate dojo at about noon. The murder occurred about 9 a.m. The two locations are about 400 miles away, and so this led to the state's theory at trial that Kensu, who was on food stamps, had chartered a private plane to go from the UP down to Port Huron to commit this murder. A ridiculous theory. There was no evidence to support it. His case is currently being considered by the CIU in Michigan. Everything I've heard is that it's progressing nicely, but again, it's just slow. There's COVID. There's some political issues at stake, but we're hopeful that, you know, relatively soon he might eventually finally be freed for this crime. Next, and this is a tough case where we think the DNA testing is going to solve it, but the court is not allowing it and the prosecution is digging in their heels. That's the case of John Brookins. He was convicted of the murder of Sheila Ginsburg. Despite there being significant evidence, the murder was actually committed by her daughter Sharon. And so John Brookins is just saying, look, let's just test the crime scene evidence because it's going to turn up that it was Sharon who killed her mother, Sheila. But the state has fought this. John Fetterman, who is the lieutenant governor and is running for Senate, has really fought on behalf of John Brookins. But the state, to this point, has been successful in waylaying that and preventing DNA testing. So at this point, it's a fight to try to get that DNA tested. And again, we think once it's tested, he'll be proven innocent. But the question is whether he'll ever get that testing.
I will never fail to be shocked at prosecutors who oppose DNA testing, because all that screams to me is that you just don't want the truth. In this case, is it that they're making the argument that, like, it's a timeliness issue? Like, what argument can you raise against this?
They're making, and this has happened in other cases too, including a famous case here in South Carolina. They're claiming, even though their theory of the case was that John Brookins committed this murder alone, that even if the DNA pointed to Sharon Ginsburg, that they would then just claim they committed the crime together and it wouldn't exonerate him. So they're just claiming, you know, this wouldn't be sufficient to prove his innocence in the case.
And Sheila's daughter, Sharon, is there any information about her whereabouts and...
Yeah, so actually, John's attorney, Craig Cooley, went down, I think she was in Florida, and spoke to her. And, you know, the way he describes it, just the look in her eyes and the way she was speaking, it, you know, ran a chill down his spine. It's like she killed her mom, and he could, you know, she didn't explicitly admit to it, but that was definitely the feeling that he got. And feels strongly and has felt strongly for years, as I feel strongly. The DNA testing will prove her guilt, but until the state relents or the courts allow it, that DNA testing is not going to take place.
So far they have successfully fought it. Does that mean John's attorneys are continuing, does it go up the appellate courts, like this fight?
Yeah, I mean, they can take it up appellate courts, they can try in federal court, this has been in state court. There are avenues out there, but it's tough. There's not an easy way to get this testing approved.
Really shameful.
And then finally, right, we just covered this case in Undisclosed. Carl Willis and Wayne Brady, as we said, were convicted of the murder of Maurice Purify. They were convicted based solely upon testimony by an alleged accomplice, Travis Slaughter. Slaughter has now recanted, saying, "I falsely confessed," and we played you the audio of his interrogation and explained why we think this is a false confession. And so based upon that recantation, Carl and Wayne have a pending motion for a new trial, and as we said, any day now, the judge could either order a hearing, could grant the motion, or, you know, less favorably, could deny the motion, but we'll keep you updated about what happens with that pending motion for a new trial.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much for this update. I've got three cases to talk about with folks. The first is Jason Carroll, which was my most recent case. It was our fall case this last year. And because, well, so Jason's case came to me from the New England Innocence Project. The attorney there, his counsel, Cynthia, when she began working on it in earnest, that's when like the COVID lockdown happened. So the last 2 years has been kind of this wall in terms of her being able to get documents she needs. His case file is not complete. As we explained, I think in the final episode, we still, his defense files have completely disappeared. It's been a struggle. So, you know, I reached out to them and I said, you know, how, what kind of update would you like to provide to the listeners? And I'm going to just read the quote that was sent back to me. "We're gathering and reviewing information with the intention to bring his case back to court to pursue his freedom and then his exoneration." And then they go on to explain that the reason they're doing this is because there's a legal mechanism to get him free first, and that's what they would pursue first before they pursue the legal process to overturn his conviction. Now, if in case you don't remember the case details, this was a case in which Sharon Johnson, who was you know, a pregnant woman, was found brutally murdered, stabbed to death. Her and her baby both died. And there is a chance that there could be plenty of robust DNA evidence somewhere in a locker somewhere. And so even the knife that they used to convict Jason was this tiny little pocket knife. That knife could still be there. These things have never been DNA tested. This was like the 80s. And I'm assuming that once they can get Jason home, because again, you know, I mean, first of all, Jason, I think he's over 50 now. He's been there a really long time. And he was 19, I think, when he was first arrested. You know, they want him home. His mother has health issues. He's got health issues. And then they would pursue exoneration, hopefully via things like the DNA testing and other things like that. So that's where we are with Jason. It's going to take some time. But I do think probably if they're in court sometime this year, maybe in the next 18 months or so, through this other legal process that they're mentioning, Jason might be able to come home. All right, Greg Lance, some very exciting developments I want to share. I'm very excited to share with you. First of all, Greg did not come to me through any attorney or any Innocence Project. I found Greg's case online and I had reached out to his mother, who had been his advocate for many years. And Greg had been representing himself pro se for, I don't know, over a decade. And I remember when I first looked at some of his documents and he'd written just hundreds of pages of petitions by hand. And it was really heartbreaking. I mean, it's so hard for somebody to do that from prison and just, you know, slogging it out by hand. And he didn't have an attorney. And even as I was investigating, he didn't have counsel. Even as we reported, he didn't have counsel. And I was kind of a pain in the ass in the side of the Tennessee Innocence Project until they finally agreed to take his case. And, you know, a lot of Innocence Projects work like this. They partner up with other private attorneys or big firms and stuff because they don't have the manpower to do it by themselves. So we were able to find an amazing firm, one of the biggest firms in Tennessee, who agreed to work on the case with the Tennessee Innocence Project. So Greg has had a fantastic legal team for the last year. And they went to court in late last year. They filed a petition, a DNA petition. Just to remind you of some of the facts of this case, Greg was convicted of the murder of Victor and Alec Klesnikow in Cookeville, Tennessee. And they had both been shot and killed, and then the house set on fire. And they lived across the street from a family, which is known as the murder clan, the Horns. And we presented lots of evidence in the series that the Horns were likely responsible for these murders. Anyhow, there is potentially a gun, you know, and all kinds of other evidence that was used to convict Greg that has never been DNA tested. There was a shirt that was found at the scene of the crime that was never disclosed to the defense and was discovered, I don't know, like 15 years later by his mom when she got some documents. And so that can be DNA tested. So DNA testing hasn't happened. So Greg's team filed a petition to get DNA testing. However, another really crazy development took place in the interim. Last year, I was contacted by Hillary Burton Morgan, who's an actor, and she hosts a series on the Sundance Channel called It Can't Happen Here. It's a great series, by the way. Every episode focuses on a case from a small town. They're all small town cases. And they were kind of fascinated with Greg's case and they wanted to do an episode. And I said, by all means, anything that'll help. And so I was interviewed. Greg's family was interviewed. His attorneys are interviewed. So all that's there. If you haven't seen it, go find it. And when the show aired last fall, there was a woman watching the show, and the name Sam Horn, again, who we think is probably the most viable suspect here, rang a bell to her. And she was like, I think I know that name. So she calls her boyfriend and she's like, wasn't your dad's name Sam Horn? And he said, yes, it was. And she's like, you need to watch the show. So it turns out that her boyfriend was Sam's oldest son. And this was a son, actually, that was from his first wife. Sam was married to a woman named Peggy Horn at the time of these murders. His first wife was also named Peggy. So Sam liked Peggy's. So this son was from his first marriage. He was much older than Sam's daughter from the second marriage, or at least a decade older. He was around 30 years old at the time of the crime. I'm not going to name the son, but so the son watches the show and he is absolutely shell-shocked because he knows about this crime because his father has confessed to him. He lived about an hour away from his dad at the time of the murder. He went to visit Sam early August 1998, which was the time of when the murders took place. And at the time he went to his dad's house, he could still see the neighbor's house smoke, like the smoke was still coming out of the ashes across the street. So this happened in like the days after the murder, like, but the house is still like smoldering. And he asked his dad, what the heck happened there? And his dad's like, well, and this is actually a quote in an affidavit that the son provided to Greg's legal team. It says, quote, son, I think I screwed the pooch this time. I broke my number one rule. And according to the son, his number one rule was if you kill somebody, don't leave any witnesses to that. Sam told his son that he had made the mistake of taking his wife, Peggy, to do the deed across the road and that she had left evidence behind. That, I'm assuming, is the shirt that we referred to in the season finale. A few months later, now...
So, Rabia, just to clarify, do the deed means what I'm thinking here?
To kill them.
Oh.
And his son, because his son knew, like, the kind of stuff his dad was into, and he just didn't want to get involved. He didn't really want to know anything about this, so he just didn't say anything to him. A couple months later, son sees his father again, and at that time, Sam told his son that Peggy, when they had gone over there that night to the Klesnikow house, Peggy had spilled gasoline all over herself, nearly set herself on fire as they were trying to set the house on fire. And then he again lamented that, quote, the stupid bitch left evidence for everyone to find. So Sam's son reached out to Greg's attorneys. First of all, he said he had no idea that somebody was convicted for this, okay? And that somebody was, an innocent person was serving time. He reached out and said, you know, my father confessed to me like more than once that he did this. But that's not where this affidavit ends. And I mean, like, it goes on to be a little more shocking. He also named another witness in that affidavit that he said that this is a witness who, when he asked around, this guy he knew said that he had been at Sam's house the night of the murder. Now, you might remember that, you know, it was a meth house. It was a crack, you know, and people came and left and they're drug running and doing all kinds of people were hanging out at the house. This guy happened to be, he said he was at the house the night of the murder, that he himself saw Sam and Peggy walk, like set the house up, like walk back to the Horn house after setting the house on fire across the street and they were reeking of gasoline. After the son heard the story, he contacted a friend of his, this is like in 2015, who was a TBI agent, and told him, thinking that this is still an unsolved murder, that, listen, my dad killed these people, okay, and his wife was involved. So he reported it to the TBI. At the time, he didn't know that somebody else is serving time for this crime. The TBI, I guess, did nothing. And, you know, all these years, we have not been able to get TBI records and files. I don't know if this would appear in that, but it is shocking to me that this was reported. But we also heard in the series that, you know, one of the witnesses, Lacey Harness, who was there that night, said that he repeatedly told the lead TBI agent at the time that it was Sam. And for some reason, they still pursued Greg. Now, the only reason I'm able to report all this is because these are all in public filings, the petition's in court, this affidavit is in court. And now, you know, the legal team has to wait and see how the district attorney responds to all this. There has been no response so far, but it's just been a matter of months. The hope, of course, would be that they would join the petition to do DNA testing, or just, I don't know what else they could do. I mean, I would hope with evidence like this new affidavit, they would just be willing to take the fastest route to getting Greg home. But now we wait and see. So some really remarkable developments in the case. All right. And the one I get asked about like every day on Twitter, I'd not say it, where we all started. I will start on a personal front and a couple of things to report on a personal front. First, Adnan has been moved from the Supermax prison that he had been in Cumberland, Maryland since 2009. Before that, he had been in a prison in Jessup, which was closed down in 2009 because of all kinds of issues and corruption and things that were said that it was a terrible place. They moved all the lifers to the Supermax in Cumberland, which was a real burden for everybody because Jessup is literally right here. It was like 20 minutes from his parents' house, 15, 20 minutes from where I live. And Cumberland is a little over 3 hours away. And so if you're going to make a trip to Cumberland to see Adnan, you're talking about an entire day's worth of driving. And then you get maybe an hour with him. So it was just really, really hard for his family. And as parents got older, making that trip was almost impossible unless they had like Yusuf, you know, the younger son with them to take them. So he was moved back and he was moved to Jessup, not to obviously that same facility that he was at before closed down, but he's been moved to a place called the Patuxent Institution, which describes itself online as, quote, a treatment-oriented max security facility. I announced this move in Adnan's Patreon a few weeks ago, and I didn't give the reason for it. But today I can share a little more information, and that was that he was moved so that Adnan can take part in a college program for incarcerated people. The facility in Cumberland was great in that it was very secure. There wasn't like a high level of violence there. And, you know, Adnan also had built a life there and had a community there. And so leaving all that is hard. But he could not take any college courses there. There's very limited programming for the people incarcerated there. So he's been moved here just for the purpose of being able to, the possibility of earning a bachelor's through this amazing program. It's with a highly recognized university, one of the best in the country. I cannot tell you what it is because I have been asked not to do that until the university themselves announces that this is they have a new cohort for this program, and Adnan say it's one of them. I do know yesterday the lead of the program reached out and said that he had the pleasure of meeting Adnan for the first time ever, and that he was just really touched at how just warm and lovely Adnan was. And I was like, yeah, I know, I told you so. Other personal news, and I'm sharing this because I get asked constantly, and I understand why, and it's a legitimate concern, and I really appreciate people's concern is how Adnan's mom is doing. People ask that because in the documentary that came out it was revealed that Adnan's mom was had cancer. And, you know, one thing I have to make very clear, there is never a time in all these years that I have asked Adnan's mom, or maybe even Adnan, how are you? And they have responded with anything other than, I'm fine, I'm great. This is just the people they are. So in the years since, every time I would ask her, because I also was surprised by that news that she had cancer on camera, I was surprised. Every time I've asked her, she's like, I'm fine. Doctor says I'm fine. Doctor says I'm fine. So what happened is this last year, one day she was not feeling well. I think she might have passed out. Like something was very badly wrong with her. Yusuf took her to the hospital. And it turned out that since she had gotten her diagnosis, she had not returned to see a doctor. And I can only assume it was a combination of fear and denial and feeling like she felt okay. So she didn't need to go. Maybe she thought, until and unless I'm sick, I don't need to go. But what had happened in those 3 years since her diagnosis is that she went from stage one to stage four. So she has had chemo in the last year. She seems to be responding well to it. But what could have been a much easier case to treat obviously has become more serious. So just, you know, keep Auntie Shamim in your thoughts and prayers. And she, as always, even today, I'll ask her, how you doing? She's like, I'm doing great. So that's how Auntie Shamim is. Now, on the case front, which is, you know, what folks really want to know is what's happening, is where we last procedurally, this case kind of ended was with a filing in the Supreme Court by Adnan's team after his conviction was reinstated at the highest court of appeals of Maryland. We lost that by one judge. It was a decision 4-3. that his conviction would be reinstated and he would not be granted a new trial. After that, you kind of had to have to go through the mechanics of filing Supreme Court, knowing that you're not going to get cert, and we didn't. And that's only so you can, I guess, just exhaust the appellate process. And what a lot of people are confused about is that they think that now that we've hit the end of the road for that appeal, that's it. He has no more appeals. No, that appeal was about a set of very specific issues. And so we have exhausted the road on those specific issues. For example, we could not now raise again in a new appeal that Asia McLean wasn't called as an alibi witness and the cell tower stuff. I mean, so, well, although...
That's not quite the case for the cell stuff.
Though. Maybe not the cell tower stuff, because that's still kind of in the...
Yeah. The Asia stuff is firmly procedurally barred, I'd say, but the cells have a different posture.
So what I'm trying to say is that Adnan can absolutely file more appeals, both in the state. He has never filed a federal appeal. He has those options. And after the ruling 3 years ago, we, you know, kind of it took about 6 months to regroup because, frankly, everybody was kind of shocked about this and it was a really hard time. But then we hired a new lead counsel, a new lead investigator, a private investigator, two women who have done a tremendous job, have just been doggedly going at this case, pulling apart the all kinds of little strings that I never even thought of, and really thoroughly investigating not just ways to get him back into court, but like legal mechanisms to get him back in court, but actually trying to figure out what happened to Haman Lee. And then last year, what happened was we got the JRA passed in Maryland, which is the Juvenile Restoration Act. And what this does is, in 2008, the Supreme Court ruled that life sentences without parole is unconstitutional for juveniles. But in the states have to, like, one by one be forced to implement this in one way or the other. And Maryland had a bit of a legal loophole because they argued that, well, it's not life without parole because the words without parole don't show up on all these juvenile life sentences, except that it is effectively because nobody gets granted life without parole. Anyhow, this fantastic law passed, JRA, which allows juveniles who have been sentenced to life to petition to have their sentences modified. I think they have to have served at least 25 years. There's about 400 individuals, incarcerated people, who in Maryland are eligible for this. And Adnan is one of them. Adnan can petition to have his sentence modified. And the question now is, I think what's happening is across the state, attorneys are just kind of like eyeing the docket and seeing how the judge is ruling on these cases before they rush to court for their clients. Because just because you have the right to file the petition doesn't mean you're going to be granted it. The judge can modify your sentence or can say, no, I'm just reinstating the sentence. But that makes Adnan's eligible to file a petition under that. And so now the question is, do we do kind of like what Jason Carroll's team is thinking, which is try to get a sentence modified or get him resentenced, get him out, and then continue to fight for his exoneration by other means like DNA evidence and other evidence of alternate suspects? Do we do this at the same time? And that's where really his legal team is still trying to put the ducks in a row of what makes sense. And again, a lot of that is because they want to see how this docket is being handled. What I want to say finally about that is that just because you're not hearing news doesn't mean there isn't news. There's a lot of crazy stuff that's happening behind the scenes in terms of the case and the investigation that I desperately wish I could share, but I'd be murdered by his attorney, and rightfully so. There is a lot happening. There's stuff happening at least every week in his case. So one day we will share all of that information with you when it is the right time. It's just not the right time. So that's where we are with Adnan Syed's case. You know, he has lots of options. I think that's the good news as far as I'm concerned. He has lots of options. But right now he's in a great place because he's starting his college degree. All right. So in closing, I want to talk with Susan and Colin about what you guys have coming up and any news you want to share about anything, personal, professional, whether or not you're going to continue to work in the wrongful conviction space. What do you have on the horizon? Colin, you want to start?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I'm currently working on a South Carolina case involving what I believe to be a wrongful conviction. It's kind of like a Sean Thomas type situation. So I'll keep you updated on that. Over the past 2 years, I've been working on a shaken baby syndrome case involving a defendant in New Jersey named Michelle Heal. And so you don't have to be a member of a bar, which I'm currently lapsed in my New York membership, to represent someone before the CIU in New Jersey. So I'm the primary attorney on Michelle Hill's case, and recently had a 400 plus page filing to the CIU there claiming she was wrongfully convicted.
Wow.
That shaken baby syndrome is junk science, and that a fall that the victim had, Mason Hess, actually caused his death as opposed to abusive shaking. So I'll certainly keep listeners updated on that. And then finally, Robbie, you mentioned Hillary Burton Morgan's series, It Couldn't Happen Here. One of the cases she covered was the case of Caitlin Conley, and this was a poisoning case, much like the Pamela Neer case. She was accused of fatally poisoning her ex-boyfriend's mother with colchicine. And so after I saw the episode on that, I tweeted about it, and then Caitlin's sister reached out to me to see if I could help. And so I reviewed all the case files and the trial transcript. She was had a mistrial, a hung jury at the first trial. They were leaning toward exoneration 10-2. She was convicted after a second trial after she changed her attorney. And so I am assisting her current appellate counsel. We're going to be filing an appeal soon, arguing that she was wrongfully convicted. So certainly still working on wrongful conviction cases, and I'll be happy to share any updates I have as they come along.
And where will you be sharing that? Like on your blog, on Twitter, like where, or on in the feed, do you think? What are you going to, how are you going to do it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly on my blog, certainly on Twitter, and then, you know, when appropriate, if it's a big enough development in the case, yeah, I'll probably drop an update into the feed.
Sounds good. Susan, what about you?
I am heading back to Floyd County.
Okay.
Yeah, so I, if you remember from season 5 of the Titus case, I remember Jacinda and Kevin at Red Marble Media, and I am working with them on a new show called Proof, and the first season is covering a case I first learned about while working on Joey Watkins' case, actually. It has stuck with me for several years, and I finally got the opportunity to give it the deep dive investigation it very much deserved. First episode is out now. You can listen at proofcrimepod.com or anywhere listen to podcasts. I think it's going to be a fantastic season, so I hope you subscribe and listen.
I will subscribe, and I think our listeners should have heard the trailer for it by now, and this is really exciting. It's a lot of work to do with a baby. How long is the season going to be?
I believe about 10 episodes.
All right. Well, good luck with that. And congratulations on the new show. Everybody go and subscribe and find Proof. Great title, by the way. Amazing that nobody's taken it. anything else that you want to share, or that's it for now?
That's it for now. And Rabia, what about you?
Well, let's see. I am obviously always going to be, you know, continuing to juggle whatever is going on with the non-stuff. You know, we are in a position now where we don't have to do a lot of fundraising for lawyers' expenses, but we do have related legal expenses. So I continue to run his Patreon and stuff. I have about 3 cases that, 2 that I'm kind of advising on. I'm advising the families and advocates on 2 wrongful conviction cases, both of which happen to be out of Putnam County in Tennessee. And one of them actually involves the same TBI agent. One of them involves the same prosecutor. So just kind of advising them on how to move forward. You know, I think when people hear our show and other shows, they think the best thing always is to, like, let's just do a podcast. Not every case requires a podcast. And so you got to really be careful. And then there's a couple of other, one case that I've begun investigating that might need a podcast type of thing, but we'll see going down the line. So I'm just kind of like working on a few different cases in my free time. I have a book coming out in November called Fatty Fatty Boom Boom. It has nothing to do with any of the stuff. It's a memoir about food, fat, and family. And it's going to be kind of hopefully light and fun, although obviously these subjects can be kind of traumatic too sometimes. I have an ongoing podcast called Nighty Night, which has been a tremendous amount of fun because I've never written like horror before. We have other writers, but I write some of the episodes. I've never written, and it is so cathartic, guys, because you can just say some of the most horrible things. And it's like, it's okay. It's horror. I can make up any kind of fantasy here. That's every other Tuesday, comes out with Cast Media. And finally, I started a fellowship with Aspen, the Aspen Institute, last year. It's in partnership with the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. And it's a 2.5-year fellowship. And the reason I'm mentioning this as relevant to this stuff is because we, in those 2.5 years, you are supposed to develop and launch a project that can potentially be like funded. They have an incredible network. They can really grow it. And we're in the very early stages of developing our projects, but my project is related to innocence. So I'm very excited about that. Hopefully in a couple years, it'll be something I can launch and it'll can have some broad impact. So it sounds like the 3 of us are all staying connected to this work. Any last thoughts you guys want to leave our listeners with? Anything, messages to them, to each other, anything?
I'll say it's been an honor and a thrill and a joy to work on this podcast for 7 years. I remember when we first started, I was just hoping, you know, we'd get a handful of people listening to three lawyers talking about innocence and wrongful convictions, and to have the loyal listeners that we've had over the years, and to be able to work on so many cases and provide some hope to some of these defendants and their families and see some of the success that they've had in their cases and proving their innocence. It's been a real joy and a thrill, and, you know, maybe the most important thing I've worked on in my life. And so thank you so much to all of our loyal listeners for sticking with us and, you know, following all these cases as we've closed some of them, and hopefully, as we described today, in the near future, might be closing some more of them and setting some more people free.
You know, this podcast has given us the chance to reinvestigate and give attention to cases that otherwise would have been forgotten or not gotten the attention they needed all along. It's been life-changing for me and for the defendants we've covered on our show. And it's been a pleasure, guys.
I will echo Susan and Colin. Look, first of all, we couldn't have done this without you amazing listeners. I know Undisclosed is not the kind of show you can listen to in little sound bites while you're, you know, you got to pay attention. And I know that means that, like, our listeners are, I think, some of the most dedicated listeners in the true crime world. It has been such a joy to meet you guys at different events. And, you know, we're still going to do the work, and we're still, and all that stuff is still out there. And so I want you to continue. I hope you continue to still care about these cases and continue to care about the defendants. And again, stay subscribed to the feed and follow Susan's work and Colin and mine as we continue to work on different cases in our own circles, which I'm sure will overlap over time once in a while. And I also want to say, Susan and Colin, you, I'm not going to get emotional here, but you guys brought life to Adnan's case when I was just thought there was nowhere to go from serial. So I am always going to be indebted to you. It's been, I mean, I think Susan, for you as well, like, I literally have changed my career because of this. Like, I was not doing this work before Undisclosed. And now I'm kind of doing this full time. And I know, I think you are too. So it's been career changing, life changing for us. And I'm always going to be in awe of the powers of the professor and Sherlock Simpson. So thank you guys for listening. And thank you, Susan and Colin, for being incredible human beings and everything you've done for all of these defendants. I'm so sorry, but somebody had to cry, right? If not the baby.
And one day we will bring Anand home. I still feel confident of that.
Listen, I think that day is this year. I really do. I've never felt it more strongly.
2022.
Let's make it happen. COVID, go away. All right, guys. Thank you so much. This is the one episode I can't say until next time on Undisclosed, right? I can't say that. Sucks. But it's okay. You'll still hear from us. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you to our executive producer, Mital Thelhan, to our audio editor, Hannah McCarthy, to Baluki for our logo, to Patrick Cortez for our theme song. As always, thank you to our sponsors for helping make these productions possible. And of course, thanks to our listeners for coming back week after week to follow these cases.